This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Our teacher, Sensei Nenzen, asked me to read this on her behalf. Jikoji is happy to welcome back our dear friend, Misha Merrill, and Dharma name,
Shungen.
Shungen. But she usually goes by Misha, as our guest teacher today. In 1976, Misha graduated from college and began showing her artwork in small galleries and earned her living as a graphic designer. In 1988, Misha ordained as a Zen priest with Les K. Roshi, who had once been a student of the founder of our temple, Kobunchino Odogawa Roshi. Misha trained at Tasahara Monastery and also trained and became a librarian. Misha received Dharma transmission in 1998 and became the teacher at the weekly sitting group called Zen Heart Sangha in Menlo Park, Woodside. Misha has been teaching tea to others, including children, for over 15 years. As Misha says it, art, gardening, teaching, tea, and her husband and animals are the crucial pieces of her pie. Meditation is her pie plate. We warmly welcome our sister, Misha, and we thank you for your teaching.
Well, that says something about Nenzen Sensei. So much too nice. So welcome everyone to Jikoji. How many are you new today? Oh, a lot. All right, welcome. This is a wonderful center. I hope that you are able to come back. Can everyone hear me, at the far reaches? Okay, I'll try to remember to keep projecting my voice. As a former school librarian, I'm used to doing that, which is why I was laughing about this, because in classrooms, that's just sort of normal. So we stopped doing classrooms like that, and they were in circles. There's no way to stay from the front then. So I imagine that whichever side of the aisle you are politically at the moment, you know that there's a lot of big feeling going on. That many people are in grief because their candidate did not win, and many people are joyous and looking forward because theirs did. And of course, as a teacher of others and students, and also still involved with the school that I taught at for 33 years, I've had lots and lots of conversations with people. And several people mentioned that they were quite upset and afraid for the future of our country, the future of democracy. And they had a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And I think many of us share that. But of course, that's a little bit the story of human life, fear and anxiety about many things. Even when, the politics is all going the way you want, your own personal life might not be. So recently, I read this really wonderful book. It's fictional, but it has a lot of wisdom in it. It's called Orbital. And it's the story of five astronauts or cosmonauts, because one's Russian, who go off to the space station sometime in the future. And they are each from different countries. I think there's possibly two Americans, an Italian, a Japanese, and a Russian. And it's kind of funny because, of course, there's all kinds of things going on Earth with the control stations. And there's politics going on. And every now and then, these people up in space, who there's only five of them, and they all rely on each other to do their job, they get these little missives like, All right, the Russians have decided blah, blah, blah down here. So you can't do this with them. Or the Americans have done blah, blah, blah down here. So in one case, the Russians are not allowed to share their toilet facilities with the Americans anymore. And they're supposed to put a note on the door reserved for Russian only. And so the Americans retaliate and say, well, then you can't share it with our foodstuffs. Up in space, of course, they're all like, oh my God. And so, there's little jokes like the Russian will say, I go to do for Russia as he enters the bathroom. And of course, they ignore everything that they're being told because there's only five of them. And they have to live together in very close quarters and do their jobs. They can't afford to have these stupid political things in between them. Anyway, this is at the very beginning where it's talking about what it is like to be at a space station. In the beginning, it's unbelievable. They're going round and round. It's eight times around the Earth every day. But it's like this. So they never go around the same area at the same time. And at first, they're all just completely awestruck. It's just amazing to see the Earth at different times of day. They can see the major rivers, the cloud cover. Soon, things change. After a week or so of city awe, the senses begin to broaden and deepen. And it's the daytime Earth, because it was the nighttime that they loved before, because they could see all the lights. It's the daytime Earth that they come to love. It's the humanless simplicity of land and sea, the way the planet seems to breathe, an animal unto itself. It's the planet's indifferent turning in indifferent space and the perfection of the sphere which transcends all language. It's the black hole of the Pacific becoming a field of gold or French Polynesia dotted below, the islands like cell samples, the atolls, opal lozenges. Then the spindle of Central America, which drops away beneath them now to bring to view the Bahamas and Florida and the arc of smoking volcanoes on the Caribbean plate. It's Uzbekistan in an expanse of ochre and brown. The snowy mountainous beauty of Kyrgyzstan, the clean and brilliant Indian Ocean of blues untold, the apricot desert of Taklamakan, traced about with the faint confluencing and parting lines of creek beds. It's the diagonal beating path of the galaxy, an invitation in the shunning void. So then come discrepancies and gaps. They were warned in their training about the problem of dissonance. They were warned about what would happen with repeated exposure to this seamless earth. You will see, they were told, its fullness, its absence of borders, except those between land and sea. You'll see no countries, just a rolling, indivisible globe, which knows no possibility of separation, let alone war. And you'll feel yourself pulled in two directions at once. Exhilaration, anxiety, rapture, depression, tenderness, anger, hope, despair. Because, of course, you know that war abounds. And that borders are something that people will kill and die for. While up here, there might be the small and distant rucking of land that tells of a mountain range, and there might be a vein that suggests a great river, but that's where it ends. There's no wall or barrier, no tribes, no war, corruption, or particular cause for fear. Before long, for all of them, a desire takes hold. It's the desire, no, the need, fueled by fervor, to protect this huge yet tiny earth. This thing of such miraculous and bizarre loveliness, this thing that is, given the poor choice of alternatives, so unmistakably home. An unbounded place, a suspended jewel, so shockingly bright. Can humans not find peace with one another, with the earth? It's not a fond wish, but a fretful demand. Can we not stop tyrannizing and destroying and ransacking and squandering this one thing on which our lives depend? Yet they hear the news, and they've lived their lives, and their hope does not make them naive. So what do they do? What action to take? And what use are words? They're humans with a godly view, and that's the blessing and also the curse. It seems easier on balance not to read the news. Some do, some don't, but it's easier not to. When they look at the planet, it's hard to see a place for or trace of the small and babbling pantomime of politics on the news feed. And it's as though that pantomime is an insult to the august stage on which it all happens, an assault on its gentleness, or else too insignificant to be bothered with. They might listen to the news and feel instantly tired or impatient. The story's a litany of accusation, angst, anger, slander, scandal that speaks a language both too simple and too complex. A kind of talking in tongues when compared to the single, clear, ringing note that seems to emit from the hanging planet they now see each morning when they open their eyes. The earth shrugs it off with its every rotation. If they listen to the radio at all, it's often for music or else something with an innocence or ultimate neutrality about it. Comedy, sport, something with sense of play, of things mattering and then not mattering, of coming and going and leaving no mark. And then even those they listen to less and less. But then one day, something shifts. One day they look at the earth and they see the truth. If only politics really were a pantomime. If politics were just a farcical, inane, at times insane entertainment provided by characters who, for the most part, have got where they are, not by being in any way revolutionary or percipient or wise in their views, but by being louder, bigger, more ostentatious, more unscrupulously wanting of the play of power than those around them. If that were the beginning and the end of the story, it would not be so bad. Instead, they come to see that it's not a pantomime, or it's not just that. It's a force so great that it has shaped every single thing on the surface of the earth that they had thought from here so human proof. So there's a writer that I really like besides this one. I love this. He wrote a very funny series of books of the Dalai Lama's cat. And all these stories have Buddhist lessons in them told from the point of view of a Siamese pussycat who it belongs to the Dalai Lama. They're very funny, but they're wonderful to read to children because it makes all of Buddhism very accessible. Anyway, the man's name is David Michi. And he also has a Substack block that he puts out something that he writes once a week. Sometimes it's another little story of the cat. There are other stories as well. And many times he speaks to the times that are happening right now. And so through a story that he was telling, he talks about politics. So it's a Rinpoche, which is like a teacher, a guru, and his main character in the story. The Rinpoche and he are talking, and all of a sudden he says, you know, Buddhism is apolitical. This politician, that party, this government. Does everyone have exactly the same view of them? Does everyone agree they are corrupt or trustworthy? There are always many views. And where do these views come from? The main character says, well, from the minds of the perceivers. Says the Rinpoche. They are the ones who suffer. The ones who see injustice and hatred, they are the ones we can help. And the main character says, well, you're not saying some politicians aren't crooks and gangsters. No, said the Rinpoche. Surely, surely, though, I persisted, we should rally around the leaders who are doing the right thing, or at least trying to. Well, of course, said the Rinpoche. But having a good leader, someone virtuous, is not always possible. The karma of those we live among, the group karma, may be too strong. Perhaps you get stuck with rulers you can do nothing about, just like us Tibetans have been with the Chinese since the 1950s. None of us wanted them. We only wanted to be left to ourselves. But they were there, in charge. There was nothing we could do. So, do we spend our lives allowing evil beings to harm us even more by allowing them to occupy our minds? They won't be affected in any way, but we are damaged greatly. The more we obsess about them, the more we allow them into our thoughts. And then the more habitual our anger and bitterness becomes. If we do this, we let them destroy our happiness. And not only in this life. So I want to go back to the starting point. Buddhism is apolitical. The Buddha's response to suffering was not to suggest social or political change. He never said that. What he talked about, what he taught, was personal transformation. This practice, Zen practice, Buddhist practice, is not politically to the left or the right. It's not even in the center. External appearances are actually of less interest than where they originate, our minds. Buddha's central premise was the objective world arises from the mind itself. And modern day physics confirms this. But I'll come back to that. So the Rinpoche says, you know, okay, so does everyone have exactly the same point of view? Well, I could ask you that right now. No, clearly not. We are a divided nation, pretty much half and half, actually, which is kind of shocking. So he says, where do these views come from? From the minds of the perceivers, us, our minds. What we perceive about ourselves and the world outside us has no objective reality. Now, that don't misunderstand. That doesn't mean that we are all permanently in an hallucinatory state. I'm not saying that. But that even though phenomena have a material basis, including politicians, by the way, how we perceive them is largely our mind's projection due to causes and conditioning. Our karma Everything that has happened to us to bring us to this moment is what makes us perceive things as we do. So if you had a really traumatic childhood, and then you go and you have your own children, you are going to do something very different than your parents did with you, if it was your parents that were the cause, because your karma is telling you, I don't want to put anybody else through what I went through. Okay, so causes and conditions bring us to this point. And each person in this room has a completely different set of causes and conditions. And so the way that you are hearing what I'm saying right now is coming through a million gazillion filters of everything that you have understood before this. Everything influences our present perception. That includes your DNA, your family's beliefs as you were growing up, the way that your family behaved, your order in the family, your schooling, your economic status, your race, your religion, your health. I have two friends, very dear friends, that are a little bit older than me, who both had polio as children. The one who lives here in California, they all then have post-polio symptoms, by the way. She wasn't able to go to school. She had to stay home. And so her grandmother took care of her during the day, and she learned to be a baker. She is a wonderful baker, and I am the recipient of much of it. But it meant that up until she was a teenager, she didn't get the chance to do what most of us did. She was taught at home, but she was not socialized in the same way. And it changed her life in a way that I actually can't understand, because that wasn't my life. So I am just curious, you could just raise your hands. I grew up in a family that was very conservative, that had moved from Michigan to California when I was 7, for which I am always eternally grateful. Because at the time, growing up in Michigan, for them, it was a very conservative place. So my parents were dyed-in-the-wool Republicans. And of course, because I grew up in that environment, for the most part, I never questioned their beliefs. I just grew up in that, and we went to Catholic church. I never questioned that. I didn't know what it meant to be something other than a Catholic, other than those were weird people who went to a different church. And then I became an adolescent, and I began to think for myself, and I began to question. And then I went off to college. And then you really start to question, right? But even after like 17, 18, you begin to think, I don't know about these old folks. So I am just curious, how many of you think that you stepped away at least a little bit from the beliefs of your parents when you got to be, a young adult? Just raise your hand. Okay, so certainly I did. Okay. In fact, I kind of did a 180. And partly that was because in high school, it was the year that Southern California did forced busing integration. So I did not go to the high school that my sister and brother had gone to. I went to a different one across town, and I had a very different experience, a much more diverse experience, socially, economically, racially. And that changed my life. Eventually, my parents also changed, but it took them a lot longer. My parents were bigoted. They were, I'm sure my father was a misogynist up to some point, but my mother let him know at some point that was not going to work. So they grew too in an environment in Southern California that was really much more liberal. And I have to say, I always respected my father, because when he finally met someone who was from a different race, a different culture, a different religion than his own, even if he'd had views before that, If that person was a good person, he was open-minded enough to change his mind. I married a Jew. When I was growing up, I only knew one Jew. My parents were very Catholic. And when I told my mother that I was going to be living with and eventually marrying a Jew, she looked outside and saw my father and just went, "Oh no." My husband and my father became the best of friends. We can change, but we are influenced by our early beliefs, the early behavior patterns of our family, our DNA. So we see the world through our own particular filters. Even when we watch the exact same event happening, we're going to see and hear something different. So when you were watching the candidates giving their talks, depending on which side you were on, you were either going, "Oh, it's a lie," or, "Oh, yes, absolutely." On either side, they were saying exactly the same thing. You were hearing exactly the same thing, but you were not responding the same due to causes and conditions, which is a fundamental understanding of the Buddhist teachings. So we may occupy the same material reality, but we each actually live in a different world, depending on those causes and conditions. And this is why people have such deeply divided views on politicians and on politics. We may believe that we're responding to what a person is saying and thereby form what we think is an objective, rational view. But actually, we are projecting a constant stream of our own thoughts, beliefs, attitudes that end up confirming our own ideas. So the Rinpoche says, you know, does everyone agree that politicians or governments are corrupt or trustworthy and there are many views? Well, so last year, I went to Mexico to a tiny little resort in a place called Troncones. And because of situation and circumstances, there were only three places you could go out to eat on the beach. I mean, you couldn't get anywhere else. You were very far from town and we didn't have a car. And so I think it was the second to the last evening, we were invited by someone at our resort to join her and some friends for dinner down the beach. We didn't know anything. It's like, great, wonderful. So we, when we got there, there was a table of, let's say, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There were 8 of us there. And we sat down. The other 6 were already there, or 5, because we came with our friend. And we introduced ourselves, and within the first 5 minutes of the conversation, I said something about how I had been the pandemic coordinator at my school during the 2 worst years of the pandemic, not realizing that these were all people who were anti-vaxxers. And it got worse. My husband was sitting here, and a woman over there, who, these are all expats, by the way, living in Mexico. She's from Canada, and she starts in, there had just been a hurricane in Puerto Vallarta that had destroyed a good part of Puerto Vallarta. And she starts talking about how, well, the United States has learned how to weaponize weather. And they created that hurricane because there was some bad guy in Puerto Vallarta that they were trying to take out, but they didn't want it to look like that's what they were doing. I didn't even know what to say. I put my hand on my husband's knee under the table. It's like, you're still here, right? We're still on the earth. Weaponizing weather? I'm sorry, that even for me, that's like... So it went on from there. And it turned out the woman I had introduced myself to was the one who was wanting Robert, at that time, Robert Kennedy, to be president. And they were anti-vaxxers. And the whole conversation, I didn't even feel like I could contribute. And there was nothing to say My husband did try a couple of times very gently to say, well, I'm really not sure about that. Oh, they always have reasons, right? And I thought, oh my God, these are people I've heard about, but I've actually never met before. So we got through the meal, continuing to be pleasant. Whatever. There was no point in making a big deal. At the end of the evening, we had to walk back across the beach with our flashlights. And my husband and I were the only people who had thought to bring flashlights. So he walked one of those women across the beach, and I walked someone else, but the woman had forgotten something, so they had to go back. So it was a while before he and I both got back to our room, and he walked in the door, and I went, oh my God, that was stunning. And he said, well, actually, it was sort of an interesting social experiment. And I said, well, yes, but here is the thing I really noticed. Yes, I did not agree with their views, but that wasn't what I came away with. What I came away with was every person at that table was so angry and so unhappy. It was just so obvious in the way they spoke, in the way they held themselves. I felt so badly for them. Just like the Rinpoche says, you know, are you going to let these people into your mind and heart and destroy your harmony? That is what it was doing to them. Those people that they're upset with, they don't know that they're upset. Who suffers first, always, with anger and hatred? We do. So we have to make an intentional decision not to spend our lives allowing evil beings, and we can call them that temporarily, to harm us even more by allowing them to occupy our minds. They won't be affected in any way. They don't even know you exist. But we damage ourselves. Obsessing about them, as the Rinpoche says, it just increases our own anger and bitterness. Right about now, though, you're thinking, as the main character in the story does, yeah, but what about the idea that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing? Your Rinpoche says, good people shouldn't do nothing. We don't have to be doormats. This comes up a lot in Buddhist practice, by the way. You know, well, I just have to be all nice and, you know, let everybody do. No, you do not have to be doormats. You don't have to allow yourselves to be trampled on. But as Buddhists, our interest is in the mind, in consciousness. And our first priority is to make sure that when we take action, we create virtue and merit, not negative karma. Taking a stand can be very useful, worthwhile, even if a solution is only temporary. The main character says, well, why only temporary? And the Rinpoche says, well, external reality is temporary. All products are impermanent. Governments, politicians especially, are impermanent. Who can remember who was the senator for Ohio 10 years ago, unless you live in Ohio? Politicians come and go. I can hardly remember the roll call for California governors. I have to really think about it sometimes. So people who seemed so powerful and important even 30 years ago, some of you aren't 30 years old, but I am at least twice that. Now we sometimes can't even remember their names. Think if you are 70, which I almost am, try to remember all the presidents from the moment you were born. You probably don't know the ones before you started. I mean, for me, Kennedy was the first, you know, John Kennedy was the first president I was really aware of because he was assassinated. Right? So 30 years ago, just think, who can you remember? Now we sometimes can't remember their names, so much better to look after what endures, mind itself. Serve others, create virtue and merit, seek a more enlightened state of being. Then you can be of the greatest benefit. What can we do? The night before, during my Sangha held a little day, an evening vigil on the night of the election, because we just all agreed sitting there watching the TV was not useful. But then we had a small bit of conversation afterwards, and one of the people in my Sangha is a little bit of a henny penny, the sky is falling all the time. And she said, oh, it's like sitting in the hallway in the hospital and your beloved is having surgery and you're waiting and waiting for the doctor to come out and tell you whether they've survived. I said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. No, it is not that bad. It may not turn out the way we want. Then we have something to deal with, but we're not there yet, first of all. And second of all, it's not a death. It's just a change. The next morning, predictably, the first person to text me was this person who said, well, the patient died. So I texted back and I said, yes, maybe. But guess what? You're still alive. You are breathing. And as long as you are alive and breathing, you can still act. She didn't like that very much, but what can we do? The Rinpoche nails it. We create virtue and merit. We seek a more enlightened state of being. And in that way, we serve others. Every time you come to a new level of personal clarity about kindness and harmony, you affect everything around you. This is not just airy fairy talking, by the way. This is reality. You can create negativity and you can create positivity wherever you go. The simplest thing you can do, a smile, a simple word, hello. I was walking at Stanford the other day with my dog around Lake Lagunitas, and there weren't very many people, but this man came by, and I turned and looked and said, hello, and walked on by, and I thought, poor baby. You know, you're so afraid, you're so tight inside that you cannot even say hello. We all got very scared during COVID. People walked on the opposite side of the street from each other. People didn't look at each other. We were all so afraid of each other. We've always been afraid of each other. Just something like COVID really exacerbated it. It's time to change that. So we need to open our hearts and open our minds. Remember, the Buddha did not say that we should be worried about social or political change. He did some of it, right? He welcomed anyone into his Sangha. Those 3,000 people that were going back and forth in India and stopping and meditating in deer parks, they were from all ranks. He had princes, he had the soil cleaners. Caste was set aside, which in those days was unheard of. It didn't matter how much money you had, it didn't matter whether you owned anything. It took him a while to accept women, but eventually, even he got there, you know, thank goodness for Ananda, right? So we have a vow. We're going to probably say it at the end. We vow to save all beings. This is a Buddhist vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. It doesn't say beings are numberless. I vow to save the ones I agree with or the ones I like. It says we're going to save them all. And how do we do this? Seems like an impossible vow. It's more of an aspiration, perhaps. But we start here. We start with meditation and mindfulness practice. We notice that how we stand in line when we go up for the meal is going to make a difference. We notice that, you know, maybe when we're in the grocery line, somebody told me this yesterday, there was a person in front of them that was all upset about something, which of course made the checker all upset. And when it was their turn to finally get up there, they smiled, made some nice comment, and the checker relaxed again. If they hadn't done that, the checker probably would have, you know, still. It's a simple thing that we do. We let someone in on the freeway, even though we don't want to. Simple things that we can do to make everyone's life better. And who is the first beneficiary of that generosity? The Dalai Lama and all these medical scientists have done all this research. They had these monks wired up. I don't know if you ever saw the picture, but there were wires coming out all over their head. And they would give them an image and all of the positive areas in the brain would light up. And then they would give them another image in the negative areas so they could identify. And then they talked about things like generosity. All the light areas came up over here. So we know that the brain is affected by our positive influences. All right. So the first thing we do is we practice awareness of mind and body. Because becoming aware allows us to see that we are the co-creators of our own reality, which, by the way, even includes the politicians that we loathe. We create this world. Once we accept the fact that we are creating this reality together, we can understand that there's actually no purpose to be stuck in outrage or fear or overwhelm. What we need to do is change the channel. We're stuck on this channel, and this channel is telling us all this negative stuff, and we're going, oh, no, yeah. We have to learn how to change the channel of that. May be their reality, but it is not mine. We have to notice the toxicity that we are allowing into our minds. What I was reading in this book, how they're looking at this beautiful marble in the sky that is home. And it's the only home we've got, folks. Whatever they're talking about, you know, going to the moon and establishing some colony there, you're not going to be outside. You're going to be inside a bubble. You are never going to have this again. This is it. They're looking at that. And then they're hearing the news. This beautiful thing and this terrible news. Dissonance, right? We're killing the very thing that we love. So, noticing that toxicity, we have the power to stop it. We do. So if politics is making you crazy right now, if it is causing you to feel despair or helplessness, change the channel. You know, I think about the Amish in this country. They don't know what's going on and they don't care. They've got their little farms. They are leading their lives that they have left. Have they been leading that life for 200 years? The world is not going to fall apart because you don't know every single thing that's happening all the time in the political world. It's okay not to be completely informed. You know, what I do is I read the summaries for the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR. You know, I just read the summary and then that's it for the day. One part of the day, that's it. It's enough. So you get to step back. You get to make that choice. Then you need to also notice this thing called a tendency towards what's called confirmation bias. You seek the opinions of those who already support your view. And you shun the opposite. This is what has happened in this country. We're not willing to listen to each other anymore. I have my ideas. Your ideas are crap, and I'm not interested in them. So it's not surprising that that person thinks that my ideas are, right? So what this does is it concretizes our perceptions. It makes them seem even more real than they actually were in the beginning. And again, it propagates more unhappiness that causes more bad karma. So where's the upside here, right? This doesn't mean, again, being a doormat and having no opinions. Of course you have opinions, you're humans, right? And you think, well, we can't do nothing. That's how evil triumphs. And you're probably thinking, but how could sitting in meditation possibly change anything? I'm just sitting here all by myself. How does that change anything? So I'm reminded when Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, was still alive, the anti-war movement was in full flower. And there was a young man in the Zendo. There was some protest going on out in the street. And there was a young man in the Zendo wearing a big poofy down jacket. And Suzuki Roshi is talking about the importance of meditation practice and all that. And he raises his hand. And he says, yes, but really, you know, what's the good of being in here? We need to be out there supporting those people, telling the government, you know, what's right. Suzuki Roshi made some kind of answer and he goes back and starts talking. And then the guy raises his hand again. He will not let it go. So Suzuki Roshi gets up out of his seat and he walks around to every single person on their shoulder, rap, rap, and says, you don't know how to practice. Rap, rap. You don't know how to practice. He goes through the entire Zendo. There's 60 people who don't know how to practice. And they're all like, because they've never seen Suzuki Roshi get so upset. He gets back to his seat. And apparently I can just imagine. Regaining his wah. And finally he says, I am sorry. But delusion is so strong. You need to stop being deluded. Some of them probably understood. I don't know about the young man. Apparently, it was very upsetting for him because when he hit him, it just bounced off because it was such a thick coat. Anyway, the fact is, there is no contradiction between recognizing that external reality arises in our minds and taking effective action. I'm not saying not to take action. In fact, when we understand the game that's being played, we are more likely to play it effectively because no one's taking you off the field. All that's being asked here is, can you sit down, regain your clarity, allow, you know, the whole image of the lotus growing in the mud. If you're moving around a lot, the mud is all coming up and the water gets all murky. If you stand still, the mud settles. And now you can look down and you can see the roots of the lotus and you can see the little fish and you have a better idea how to step forward. But if you're running around The patient died. What you're doing is you're mixing up all that mud. You're getting yourself all crazy and rushing off to do something and probably doing it poorly because you are not in a clear state of mind. Should we choose to participate in political action, we are to be guided by virtue. Now, this is an old-fashioned word, I know, but in Buddhism, virtue is defined as a cause of happiness. So, like I said, when I left the table that night at dinner, all I could feel was such sadness for the unhappiness of these people and knowing that I had failed in any way to offer them some happiness other than perhaps being a nice dinner guest. But that I wasn't wise enough or capable enough to say something that might have turned it because I couldn't see how to do that. These are the two foundational virtues of Buddhism, the wish to give happiness to others and compassion, which is the wish to free others from suffering, really, right? When we finally really get it, the destructive force of negative mental patterns, we will change. Because, as at that dinner, sometimes no matter what actions we do or do not take, the other side wins, right? Remember, it's not just you. There's a group karma. There's your individual karma, but there's also a group karma. And the group karma in our country right now is that over half the people feel disenfranchised. They feel like life is not going the way they want it to go. They want change. They want someone who's going to make that happen. And they think this is the way it's going to be. The other half, the slightly less half, is convinced exactly the opposite. But we have the opportunity to just cut through that altogether. Most of us here, in fact, I'm pretty sure all of us here, are small people. Not individually small, but small in the sense that your political influence is small. Perhaps your income is small. Perhaps your sphere of influence is small. But your heart is huge. Your heart has no limits. Your mind has no limits. That is your area of influence. Right? Somebody told me last night that he called, what did he say? He called Robert or Giuliani? I don't, somebody high up there and complained about something. I was like, you got a hold of him? I was like, what? It never occurs to me to call. You know, I might want to write my congressman, but you don't have that much influence, but you can complain. You know, you can offer your suggestions, but don't allow the ones that you dislike to live rent-free in your head. Those unwanted tenants can be evicted. You could just say, I don't want to think about you anymore. Right? Get out of my head. I don't want to hear your voice. I don't want to hear your thoughts. I do not want to hear that negativity. Right? However, getting rid of negative thoughts in your own mind is difficult because of habits and conditioning. If you grow up in a family where there's been a lot of anger, then that is a habit that you probably have taken on yourself. I have been working on anger and patience since almost the beginning of my Zen practice. And I have to say, it works. I am definitely less angry and a lot more patient than I used to be, but I still have to deal with it, right? It's a lifelong project. The problem is you should be thinking,
I'm sorry, the bill for the...
We have to stop.
Yes.
Yeah. It rang about 10 minutes ago.
Oh, well, I'm so sorry. I just kept going on and on. What I want to leave you with is get those negative thoughts out of your head to the best of your ability, and then go out and do something. Make good trouble, as John Lewis would say. Thank you so much. Sorry to.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.